you had told me that at the All-Star break, I would have been, are you having a fever dream or what?
Well, number one, I think it just makes playing minor league baseball a lot more fun if you're winning.
You are no fun. Absolutely no fun at all. And welcome to episode number 76 of Artificial Turf Wars, where we're not nearly as terrible as meaningless games in September. I'm your host, Greg Wisniewski, and I'm joined this week by Joshua Housam. Josh, sir, are you there?
I am here.
He is present and accounted for. We have a few things to talk about this week. We have Bautista's final homestand and really what we believe to be the most appropriate time to say goodbye to him. We have Josh Donaldson tearing it up. Teoscar Hernandez also tearing it up, which was not something I was expecting to be talking about this year. But hey, he wasn't even a Blue Jay to start the year. Marcus Stroman is marching towards a milestone. We have an interview with TJ Zoik, who was a first-round pick of the Blue Jays, but is a Blue Jays farmhand right now and going to the Arizona Fall League. So we were checking in with him. He was gracious enough to join us. We have your questions. And, we might squeeze in a couple things after that. Well, this is the teary-eyed moment, Josh, that we all had on the weekend where Jose Bautista played what many would have to assume is the final home game of his Blue Jays career.
Yeah, and we would get a question about this later, but just in the context of this, it's hard to see it not being that just because of, he's not going to come back as a starter and there's no room for him as a backup because he doesn't offer any defensive value.
Yeah.
So, the fans came out in droves over that six games homestand against Kansas City and the Yankees, but really in that final series and just to show Bautista love all weekend, which he absolutely deserved.
Yeah, I'm 100% with you. I have seen a couple of the Bautista troll type haters on Twitter, but overwhelmingly, people have a real appreciation for the role that he played in this franchise's resurgence. I don't think he did a lot to put behinds in the seats for the first couple of years when the team was, objectively not competitive. But for us who were, the diehard fans, he really made this team watchable in a way that it would not have been for me had Jose Bautista not been there.
We talked about this last week with that face of the franchise conversation, but it's the same concept. Like, the Jays were watchable in the 2000s because of Roy Halladay and at the beginning, Carlos Delgado. And from 2010 until 2014, 13, they had some players. But for that, basically up until they made the playoffs, it was Jose Bautista.
Mm-hmm.
It was watching one of the very best players in the entire sport play for the Blue Jays, which is not something that's always the case, obviously.
No, you that's and the fact that it was a lucky stroke of I don't know what circumstances as it's been outlined in one online article that I read this week. But however it worked out, it was not like we're seeing with Vlad Guerrero Jr. right now, right? The exact opposite of that. Vlad right now, if he doesn't turn out to be at least a good major league regular, there's just going to be people like, what happened to this kid? Which he may not turn out to be a major league regular, but Jose Bautista literally exploded out of nothing. And that was part of the magic. And I think that's easy to forget 6 or 7 years later.
And yeah, and just to add to that, I think that part of it too is unlike Vlad Guerrero, who was made long before he came and will be made through the minors, Jose Bautista was made as a Toronto Blue Jay.
Mm.
And I think that adds some mystique. Like, even Edwin Encarnacion, who turned into a superstar as a Blue Jay, he was still a good player when he came over. Whereas Bautista went from being a guy that was a journeyman who no one really wanted to a superstar here. And I think that sort of helped people identify them even more than they already would.
The feeling that your franchise has done something right, that it's made a right decision in order to get a player, that it's coached the player right or developed the player right or believed in the right player at the right time. All of those things make you feel good as a fan, right? when they traded for Mike Sirotka and he was injured and they never got any compensation for that, for me, that was the straw that broke the camel's back back in, you know, the post-strike days. I was like, this whole thing is a joke. The franchise doesn't know its head from a hole in the ground. And why would I watch a team that can't even get compensated for a disaster of a trade? So, yeah, when the opposite happens, it's really, really a good feeling. And emotionally is where you have to connect to a team that never gets over 90 wins.
Yeah. Or do they even get over 85 at that in that tenure? But
pretty much.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's all this we're talking about kind of makes it sad the way it ended.
He certainly went out with a whisper and not a bang.
Yeah, he did. And you know, this was tweeted out by Scott Carson, the stats guy for the Blue Jays earlier today, or former, I don't know if he's like still there. The record, if you want to call it that, for the worst batting average ever for a qualified Blue Jay was Aaron Hill 2010, who hit 204.5454. Well, 0.2045454. As of the recording, Bautista is 1-for-3. Which puts him at 0.2045060666. So percentage points behind Aaron Hill. But the fact that we're in this conversation for the worst batting average ever for the Blue Jays is very sad when we're talking about arguably and probably the greatest player ever.
And I think you can only soften that blow by looking at, you know, trying to distract yourself with some of the other things that have gone sort of okay for Jose, in terms of he has been able to play the outfield at what I would call, you know, with his arm obviously better than it's been for 2 or 3 years, that there's some actual outfield assists, not the limp arm. There is the fact that in that endless march of Blue Jays statistic leaderboards, he did pass tonight when he hit a home run. He passed Vernon Wells for second all-time in runs scored. Not that runs scored are a big stat, but it tells you just how much longevity he's had with the franchise.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, on this context of things he's done, he's ending strong. You know, he's got hits in his last few games. He's got the home run today. And we sort of got some Bautista bingo. As soon as he throws somebody out, we'll have everything because, you know, we had the adventures on the bases. We had him getting thrown out of a game. It's everything. Everything we've seen over the years, we were getting in this last stretch of games.
Yeah, I think it takes a special kind of talent. I saw what the conversation probably was from Bautista to get thrown out at home plate, and I almost feel like the umpire felt like Jose wanted to get thrown out one more time just to remember what it felt like.
He was out, but yes.
Well, yeah, I mean, you could say that's a ball, that's a ball. Usually that doesn't get the immediate ejection going, but I'm not sure. Maybe that umpire likes to eject people. I didn't look that up.
Nah, it's just honoring. He was honoring Bautista like the rest of us. And on the topic, we should probably discuss how the team did it on Sunday.
Yeah. You want to outline that?
Sure. So I was there, which was, I was, you know, living in Toronto. I was not going to miss that one, especially because I have tickets, right? So when I was there, the players started out running on the field. It was just Bautista, and the other guys stayed in the dugout. Bautista ran out to the field to Trophies, which is one of his old walk-up songs. What we didn't get in the stands is that he didn't know that was going to happen. The players acted like they were going to run out with him, and they just let him go by himself. And then he realized it partway through and started clapping and waving. And that was a very classy, cool way to start it. I loved it.
Yeah, and I think it definitely shows that his teammates have a great amount of respect for him as the franchise, as it were.
That couldn't have been more clear just in that moment, or the way it ended either.
Yeah, now, before we get to the way it ended, a couple little things. The Yankees stayed off the field during that as well, to my understanding, and held back. As well, he switched his walk-up song to Oh My God for his final, which was the same walk-up song he had when he hit 50 home runs, which I think that tells you that he, you know, he wants to give a nod out to the fact that this is probably it for him, but he doesn't want to just come out and say it, obviously.
Yeah, and you know the way he's talking, he doesn't want it to be the end, even though it's going to be. but that was kind of a neat movement. And what preceded that, Marcus Stroman warmed up in his jersey from 2010 as well.
Mm-hmm. Which he stole out of a display case somewhere.
Well, he had someone else steal it for him, but did that just increase his auction value? I don't know. But
it's game worn jersey twice now, sort of. Not really, maybe.
But all this stuff just speaks to the respect that both the players and Bautista have for the history that he has been a part of here in Toronto.
And of course, that led to him coming off the field by himself, being replaced defensively after the first out of the ninth, right?
Yes.
Which gave him a chance to come in and embrace and shake hands with everybody pretty much except for Osuna, who was on the mound and saluted him, and Russell Martin, who was, well, busy, but, you know, a couple guys took their hats off for him even on the field as a show of respect. All of that. Just it was so consistent. There was really, it was clear what the message was. It wasn't anybody just sort of brushing it off.
Yeah, and all of that stuff happening really makes it feel like it's the end. If it was just the fans reacting, you know, as they did all weekend, especially on the Sunday, standing up and cheering for every single one of his at-bats, it would be hard to say, okay, well, it's definitely he's not coming back. But when the team is acting in that fashion, and he is, it sort of brings it the realization to everybody that this is the end.
Yeah. And it is a little bit sad. No doubt about that. It's a lot less sad than the way maybe Roy Halladay had to leave without ever tasting the playoffs, or that Carlos Delgado had to leave without ever being really offered a fair contract. Like, given all that, it's sad, but I mean, I guess appropriate is my feeling on the whole thing.
Yeah, I think so. And it's funny to talk about this, too. I mean, when was the last time a Blue Jays player who was a superstar played out the string like this? I can't even think of an example unless you count Tony Fernandez coming back for the 400th time.
Tony Fernandez had like a car that just drove itself back to Toronto and he never... Am I here again? Oh, okay. Yeah, players tend not to be able to say goodbye in Toronto appropriately, because there's always something else on the horizon. Toronto just, it isn't where you end your career typically. I don't think there is a comparable example.
I mean, if you think back to Delgado, obviously, who had many good years out after Toronto, he left on a sour note because he wouldn't waive his no trade clause because he didn't want to leave like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the last truly great hitter this team has ever had. And he was booed out the door. And so it's nice to be able to say goodbye properly to Bautista.
For sure. All right. We are going to move from the King, I think, now to the heir apparent, Josh Donaldson.
So the prince?
I don't know. The steward?
Stewards aren't heirs to kings.
I don't know. He's been keeping the throne warm all second half until someone gives it to him, because he's just lost his mind since coming back from injury.
Oh, I mean, it's been just stupid, really. I mean, the last 2 weeks, he's got 8 home runs. In, I mean, 8 home runs in 2 weeks of games? That's not supposed to happen, especially for a guy who... everyone was saying having a down season.
Did he not have 9 home runs in the first half?
Yes, I think that's right, actually.
I'm pretty sure, because he's got like 33, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, he's hitting, and for the last 8 games, which is since we did record the last podcast, he's hitting .345, .406, .724 with 3 home runs and 2 doubles.
His last 8 road games, Sportsnet put up a stat, and his OPS was like over 2,000. For
I saw that one too.
8 road games? Who hits that on the, like, you friendly confines, screw that, man. I'm just gonna bash everywhere. So Donaldson's still the real deal, which makes for a better decision that the Blue Jays have to make, but a more difficult decision.
He's also gonna cost more money too.
Yeah. How do you pay Josh Donaldson, and how long do you plan on paying him for?
Yeah, I mean, especially when you look at his overall numbers, they're right maybe just a little lower because of the overall league offensive environment, but they're right there where they've been the last 2 years. His OPS last year was 953. His OPS this year is 953.
Now, if you had told me that at the All-Star break, I would have been, are you having a fever dream or what?
Seriously. And he's only played 110 games and he's got 33 home runs. That's a 47 home run pace if he plays his 155 that he normally plays.
Which is
48 if he plays his normal 158 from the 3 years prior.
Which is what he does, right? He hits over 40 bombs a year if he's healthy. And we thought he would be healthy, and he wasn't. So you still have now a guy who can put the whole team on his back, much like Bautista or Encarnacion in their prime, and drag them through a few wins when you're really, you know, stuck. And you kind of need at least one guy on the team who's going to do that, don't you?
Yeah, I think you definitely do. The what separates the Blue Jays from 2 years ago, essentially, to this one is they had three or four guys that were that. Whereas this year, it was Smoke in the first half, and Donaldson kind of took over when Smoke went down. But he is the guy that they need. And that's where this conversation you were talking about before comes into play. It's hard to let that guy walk when he's still that guy.
Mm-hmm. It's also hard to pay that guy for like 6 years when you know he's in his 30s.
That's also true. And this is, you know, this is a conversation for another day.
So we'll just leave it at Josh Donaldson, still awesome, despite what you may have heard through April, May, and parts of June.
Yeah.
There is another name that has suddenly sprung forth, and that is the Teoscar Hernandez hype train is fully fueled and honking its horn in the station or whatever it is, blowing its whistle, because his OPS is up over 900 at the moment. I'm not even sure how that happened, except that every time he hits the ball, it seems like it's an extra base hit.
Well, of his last nine hits, five are home runs and two are doubles.
This seems respectable.
That's in his last eight games. He's got five bombs his last eight games.
So my question is, I know being in the friendly park that is the Rogers Center encourages hitters who are power hitters to you know, realize that potential. It doesn't work for all of them. But is the idea of a flawed power hitter as a Blue Jays project now just a thing? Is that what they do?
We have seen a few of them, haven't we?
Even the lostiest of lost causes, Justin Smoke, finally came around and turned himself into an everyday player somehow. But we have seen, you know, and Bautista was obviously the first one who fit that mold. And nobody's been at that level since then. But there's sort of an argument that whatever's going on there development-wise or strategy-wise, are they looking for guys that other teams are like, oh, this guy's got power, but nah, we can't turn him into an everyday guy.
Yeah, it's hard to really answer questions like that about the way this team builds guys and how this just keeps happening. I think that you're hitting on something with the field and how it just helps power players. You know, it helps players really tap into the power that they've already shown. Like Teoscar Hernandez had power in the minors. People looked at him as a guy who would, you know, hit 20 plus home runs and steal 20 plus bases a season and strike out, you know, 180 times. So that means that's what he is. I mean, you know, in those eight games, he's also struck out 12 times.
But does it matter if you hit a couple bombs and a bunch of doubles?
Of course not.
Yeah, this is the era where that doesn't matter. And by the way, just as another side note, maybe we should keep Teoscar around, play him every day so Bautista doesn't sit with the single season strikeout record for so many years.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's depressing. But the one thing about these hitters, though, these guys that have the extreme swing and miss, which we saw with Justin Smoke the last couple of years, if you're not hitting the ball, it's hard to hit to your power when people figure out where you miss it.
True. True.
Right? You know, Justin Smoke was, you know, throw him curveballs down and he's going to swing over them all the time. That was Juan Francisco from a couple years prior. And eventually, and probably very quickly, people will realize where those holes are in Teoscar Hernandez's swing and exploit them until he can make an adjustment and become a better hitter overall, like Smoke did this year.
So, yeah, the question ultimately is, do the Blue Jays have a confidence that they can coach him to close up that hole in his swing, which from what I read briefly is actually in the upper part of the zone for Hernandez?
It's them high heat.
Probably. We had one other player marching toward an important milestone, quote unquote important. I'm sure it's important to him. Marcus blocked me on Twitter. Stroman is headed towards 200 innings. How short is he?
Real short. Yeah. 5'7".
That's for blocking me on Twitter, Marcus.
Didn't last week you say he was going to block the podcast? If he didn't last week, he's doing it this week. he's at 197 innings, so he just needs to last 3 innings in his next start against the Yankees to clear that milestone. And it is important to him because he thinks of himself as an ace, and aces throw 200 innings. It's just kind of the accepted number.
So he needs to last longer than Marco Estrada did in his final start of the year?
No.
What happened, Josh?
He sucked.
Okay. Well, good to know.
One of the funny things about Stroman, since I don't want to talk about that anymore, but Estrada bad thing. In the end, his numbers, if you look at base runners allowed, home runs allowed, are going to be almost exactly the same as they were last year.
Mm-hmm.
But his ERA is a run and a half lower almost.
Now, what's the lesson here, Josh?
Baseball's a random game.
And therefore, we shouldn't use ERA to try and figure out what a guy's going to do the following year.
Right.
It's a basic sabermetric principle, and he's a wonderful, wonderful example of it this year. Honestly, it's nothing Marcus Stroman should do any differently.
He hasn't done anything differently.
Yeah, but like next year, he shouldn't have done anything differently from last to this because his peripherals were good. They were what they were, and he got some what we would consider unfair results based on the way he was doing things. And this year it's been much more generous to him. But that doesn't mean that he figured something out this year and his ERA is going to be the same next year. His ERA is going to fluctuate. That's your sabermetric lesson for today. Don't use ERA to try and predict how a guy is going to be next year because it's not going to tell you enough.
Yeah, and when we're talking about Marcus Stroman specifically, it's really not going to, because it's one thing. If you have a guy who's an extreme strikeout pitcher, his ERA is probably going to be reasonably stable just because he limits contact, whereas Marcus Stroman does not. His game is extreme ground balls. And depending on who you have out in those fielding spots.
Totally. And depending on who is positioning them, even. There's tons of variables there that Marcus is focused on one thing, getting the pitch into a spot where a guy's going to hit it on the ground. Beyond that, he's at the mercy of everything that happens behind him. So we'll go with that.
And, just on that topic, what's somewhat amazing about his numbers being so much better from the runs allowed, well, earned runs allowed, he gave a bunch of unearned runs this year. He was dealing with infielders whose range was greatly diminished.
Mm-hmm.
We had Donaldson wasn't there for most of the season. Tulowitzki had dips in his ratings. Goins had dips in his. Barney was a negative. Everyone was a negative defender on the infield except Justin Smoke, but he's a first baseman. And yet Stroman did this. So it just shows the randomness that you were talking about earlier.
Exactly. Is there anybody else who we have an update on? I didn't have anybody on the notes here, but before we move on, I usually give you a chance.
Well, yeah, I think that it's just, I think we're going to see just on these relievers that we've been talking about, Barnes and DePera, I think they might just throw one more time each because they have eased back on their usage for both of them, which was, we talked about, and it's nice to see they actually did it.
Praise Jeebus, as Homer Simpson once said, because why would you kill these guys in meaningless games when you're going to need to really count on them, hopefully next year, a whole lot just like this year? So, yeah, good to know. We are going to go talk to a real live pitcher in just a couple of seconds. TJ Zoik is a Toronto Blue Jays minor leaguer, and he's going to be back with us in just a sec. And we are pleased at Artificial Turf Wars to have joining us a TJ Zoik, who is a Toronto Blue Jays first round draft pick from 2016. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So I guess since you are a recent first round draft pick, which is a big accomplishment for any player, we wanted to talk to you about what it was like being a college player to suddenly being a professional. What was draft day like for you?
Well, it was pretty emotional. A lot of anxiety leading up to that. You work your whole life to get to this point and to get an opportunity to play pro baseball, and then when you get to draft day, it's completely out of your hands. So, it's kind of a weird feeling. You feel like you control most of it for the better part of your career, and then it all comes down to one day where you really don't control anything. So, it was obviously ended in a great result and exactly what I had been hoping for and working for. Leading up to that day, leading up to the draft, and all throughout the first 20 picks, just a big feeling of anxiety.
I can imagine.
Now, did you have an idea that Toronto was seriously interested in taking you at that spot?
Not until about 2 days beforehand. I hadn't really talked with them a whole lot. The area scout had come and met with me and talked briefly, like a lot of others, wasn't in school and in the season. But then they seemed to get their interest seemed to spike in me just a few days leading up. I was actually back home in Mason, Ohio, and they had an area scout from that area come, and I did this personality test that everybody, every team has their own version of, and they were talking to my agent and all this, and obviously that kind of tipped off to me that they obviously had some interest in taking me there. But then, on draft night, I get a call around the 19th, 20th pick that said, "Hey, Toronto is interested in taking you here. What do you say?" I said, I was very happy to accept that their offer.
Yeah, well, we're obviously happy that you did. But I want to actually now take this back before, because this was not the first time you were drafted. You were drafted, of course, at a high school, like you said, in Mason, Ohio. And I'm wondering, how did you end up making the decision to go to Pittsburgh? Because, for a lot of players who are drafted out of high school and look like they're potential pros, they pick a school very much based on their baseball acumen. And I'm wondering how much it was that versus the education you get at a very good school like Pitt.
Well, it was a little bit of both. At that time, when I had gone up to visit, that Pitt had finally made the decision to leave what was the Big East and join the ACC. So I knew I was going to get a lot of great baseball competition when I, when I was in season playing against schools like Florida State, Miami, Clemson. I was going to be playing against guys who were, potential first round, second round, top five round picks. To obviously get good enough to be one of those guys, you have to play against them and learn, how to play like that. And then on the other side, it's a great school. Like you said, the education is, top notch, and, you never know with baseball. You could get hurt, doesn't end up working out. So I felt like that was a great fallback plan to have a great education and a degree from that school.
Now, is that something if you're talking to potential people who are like where you were a few years ago, would you counsel them to maybe go to the better academic school just in case, as long as they still have the chance to be seen?
Yeah, I always tell guys, if you're good enough, you're going to be seen. It doesn't really matter where you are. I mean, if you look at the Major League Baseball All-Star Game, how many of those that came from schools that aren't necessarily premier baseball programs, you don't always have to be at LSU, Florida, Mississippi State, one of those big name programs just to be seen. If you play well enough, then, you have potential. The guys are going to see, they're going to find you. They have area scouts all over the place for a reason.
So you went from very much being the master of your own destiny, turning down the first draft, and then you were drafted, like you said, out of your control what happened there, but you were fortunately picked in the first round. And then you went, the Blue Jays bounced you from the FSL over to Vancouver and then to Lansing all in 1 year. What was it like suddenly being a pro and kind of have Mitt will travel?
Well, it was a very enjoyable experience. Something very new to me. Obviously, you know, starting off in the GCL, I started off down there mainly to kind of build up. There had been about a month or a month and a half gap between when I was drafted and the last time I had thrown a baseball. So they obviously didn't want to just ship me off, you know, up to Vancouver and, you know, be away from the trainers and the facility, which is, you know, where their main complex is here in Dunedin, Florida. So they wanted me to be able to work with those guys and be closely monitored while I was going through my throwing program and building up. And then after I had made my first start in the GCL, they decided it was okay to send me out to Vancouver.
Your impressions of Vancouver as a city or as a place to play ball?
Oh, it's beautiful. In both ways. You know, the fan base there is incredible. You know, we unfortunately didn't play all too well while I was there. But, you know, even so, the crowds would sell out almost, I feel like, every other night. They're, you know, cheering loud. Great atmosphere. And the city itself is just phenomenal. You know, I was fortunate enough to be able to, you know, on some off days, be able to walk around downtown and, you know, see a lot of the sights. And it's an amazing city.
Now, did the club ask you to make any changes or adjustments from college to the pros in either your repertoire or mechanics, or was it just go out and we'll see what we've got and then it works and keep going with it?
I think it was more of a, we'll go out and see what you got, and then, you know, we need to make some adjustments, some minor tweaks. We'll do that. Obviously, coming right out of college, you're obviously not big league ready, so there's obviously going to be some adjustments that have to be made. But it's been a good work in progress. Last year helped me a ton, just kind of, you know, how to develop a routine and kind of be in pro baseball, be in that five-man's rotation. And then this year, especially being with down here and with the Dunedin Blue Jays, with the pitching coach down here, has done a tremendous job with me and even all of our pitchers down here, just kind of helping us develop a ton.
So with that development in 2017, we don't get a lot of information from the minor league clubs about DL stints and that, but you did unfortunately have to make two trips to the DL, which I'm sure was disappointing. Now that you're in Dunedin, you know, and you moved up another level. What happened there this season that caused you trouble?
Well, the first time it was a lower back injury, nothing super serious. It's just something that required a lot of rest to kind of let it heal itself. And then I had to make some adjustments to some of my routine, just kind of add some things to keep this problem from coming back. Then the second time, I had just, you know, my arm was just not in shape enough to be ready to go out and compete and give my team the best chance to win. I just wasn't feeling quite right. So they took me back onto the DL. I went through a rigorous throwing program to get my arm in shape quick. And then after I came back off of the DL for the second time, my arm had never felt better. Obviously, I was still pretty fresh from the year, the short year I had, unfortunately, but it did, and still does feel great.
And luckily you were able to make it back to pitch for the playoffs. What is this, the value? I mean, obviously you want to win. That's why you play baseball. But do you think there's an added value as someone coming up through the system to winning a championship in the minor leagues?
Well, number one, I think it just makes playing minor league baseball a lot more fun if you're winning. but I think, being a part of a winning culture, you know, even the big league club has been, you know, to the playoffs at least the last 2 years. You know, just from top down, they've developed a winning culture. And, you know, guys, everybody at every level wants to win. You know, you can see it. You know, some years might go better than others. It's just, you know, the ball might bounce one way or the other. But, you know, you can feel that. At every level, the manager, the assistant coaches, they all want to win. And that's the main goal is development. And, you know, you want to win.
Yeah, makes sense. Now, as you said, that you came back and you haven't thrown as many innings as other guys. So the team is going to be sending you to the Arizona Fall League, if we have that correct.
Yes, that's correct.
So what is the process between the end of the season and the Fall League, which obviously takes place well after the end of the minor league season, to keep you in shape?
Well, I went home for a few weeks after the playoffs had ended down here. I did get that, you know, it's kind of a good and a bad thing. Obviously, you don't want to miss any of the season, but that, you know, that long break that I had did allow me to kind of keep innings off my arm, so I could, after the playoffs ended, just keep throwing and keep throwing through that little 2-week break I had. And now I'm back down here in Florida, you know, continuing to throwing sides, you know, just kind of, you know, getting ready to go out there and compete again.
Will you actually throw to any live hitters before the fall league, any instructs or anything like that? Or is it just keeping your arm warm, essentially?
Yeah, we will throw to live hitters, I believe, right towards the end, right before we leave. I think that'll be our last trip off the mound before we head out to Arizona.
So the AFL is a very sort of different format from everything you've been doing lately, because the prospects from each team are kind of a mishmash of different organizations and different guys you may not have met. So what's your approach there? Are you doing it for yourself? Are you doing it to try and sort of learn as much as you can in that, or are you just trying to hone a specific skill?
Well, I think a little bit of all the above. You know, you kind of go and see how other guys go about things, you know, other top prospects from other teams. They are where they are for a reason, right? So you kind of see if you can take something from one guy, maybe something from another guy, and, you know, and work on what I'm doing as well while I'm out there, you know, facing, you know, top-level hitters, at least top minor league-level hitters. Would be great for me to kind of learn how to pitch, you know, kind of beat hitters better, call my own game better. It's going to be a great learning experience to be out there and facing those type of guys.
When you talk about you know, trying to hone things and that, I'm curious, just as a sort of a last thing, is there someone in the major leagues right now who you try and look up to, or something specific that you're trying to emulate? I know even some MLB pitchers will talk about another elite guy. Is there someone who you compare to yourself or compare yourself to?
Well, absolutely. I would say there's at least two guys, Adam Wainwright and Corey Kluber, that I look up to. I wouldn't necessarily compare myself to them because they're on a whole other level, even at the highest level. But yeah, I definitely try to model myself after those two. They're both the workhorse. They like to go out there and give their team 7-8. You know, the quality start for them is, like I said, 7 or 8 innings, not just 6. You know, they're the type of guys that, you know, when they go out there, their whole team and the fans know that, hey, we got a chance here.
That's cool. That's very cool. So yeah, those are certainly two guys I would put at the top of the game as well. We do appreciate you stopping by. I think we learned a lot about you, and I hope that next season you can get through it, you know, in one piece, and you can make that next step up the ladder.
Yeah, that'd be very nice.
We look forward to hearing your name more often, TJ.
All right, thank you guys.
All right, take care. And there you have it, a little bit about what the life of a draft pick suddenly becomes from Mr. Zoik, which it sounds hectic, to say the least. You're always running from one place to another to try and be the best you can be.
You know, it was interesting to know how late into the game the Jays really got into it with Zoik. The way he said it was just a couple days before the draft, really, he found out they were interested.
Yeah, I also like this statement, though, that they're going to see if you need to be seen, they're going to see you, which
that's why I wanted to ask that question. I because people never talk about this aspect. You see all these guys like Garrett Cole and Trevor Bauer going off to UCLA, or someone going off to Miami or Rice or wherever. He went to Pitt, which is a good school, and it has baseball. They play against good teams. But, you know, he's like, you have the talent, they're going to find you. And I think that's a message that needs to get out there more than it does.
Yeah, I think it's probably as time has gone on and teams have become more and more aggressive about finding talent and knowing what they were looking for in terms of talent, I have a feeling that that's been more true in, you know, post Moneyball baseball era, where there are no teams just sort of sitting back on their heels, I don't think, anymore.
Mm-hmm. Especially if you're playing college ball, D1 college ball, you're going to play in front of scouts a lot, yeah, regardless of where you are.
Even if they're not looking for you, surely they're going to be looking, seeing you, and they're looking at someone else, I would presume.
Yeah. And obviously in TJ's case, they were looking for him, but
absolutely. You don't, I don't think he accidentally became a first round pick after being already picked once out of high school. Anyway, yeah. We have,
but anyway, we're looking to see him next year and rooting for him. So thanks for coming on, TJ.
And now to our listeners and a certain number of questions they have for us.
Time now to hear from our listeners.
That just seems silly.
Here are the rules. First, I ask a question, then you ask a question.
Now, how does that sound, sweetheart?
Could you repeat the question, please?
Yeah, well, no, really once is what we usually manage with questions, but thanks for asking. We're going to start with, you think Mike's son? Yeah.
Sure.
Get this one out of the way, Mike. Doctor. Mike's. Should we call him doctor when he asks this question? Would you rather fight 100 mouse-sized Jose Bautistas or one Jose Bautista-sized mouse? I'll hang up and listen.
Go ahead, Greg. You can take this one first.
I would rather fight one Jose Bautista-sized mouse. I figure probably less intelligent than 100 mouse-sized Jose Bautistas. I wouldn't want to get hit by a whole bunch of little tiny bats.
I'm going the other way.
You're going the other way?
A person-sized mouse would scare the hell out of me.
I don't want to be swarmed by 100 mouse-sized Jose Bautistas with little... No, man, I'm out.
But like, if these 100 mouse-sized Bautistas are coming after me, I can just stand on a chair and they can't get to me.
Well, I'm glad we didn't settle that at all, really. It opens us up for all kinds of questions next week. Luke, who has changed his name to include JBats Forever at Split Letters, asks, what's next for the God King himself? Not, I'm assuming not Joey Votto. Does he get a big league deal somewhere?
Joey Votto's not the God King. Don't even make that joke.
Joey Votto is the court jester.
I'll give him that one. He's your steward.
Oh, there we are.
But I think Bautista will get a big league contract somewhere if he really wants it. As a role player or sharing time with someone. I think that some team will offer him a deal just in case last year is closer to real than this year, or just the lightning in a bottle for like $2 million, or someone will pay him. I just don't think it'll be Toronto. And I also don't know if Bautista will be willing to take that rather than just retiring.
Yeah, it's a long way down from the 5 years he was seeking from all or more, I'm not sure, but at the beginning of the 2017 season. I think Bautista, some call him cocky, but I think he also sort of has a level of self-respect, maybe, that he doesn't necessarily sound like the kind of guy who would go for a part-time role at this point. I would be less surprised, to see him show up coaching somewhere than I would to see him as a part-timer.
Yeah, and I think that's it. I don't think it's the money. I think it's the role. I just don't think he wants to come off the bench, and I don't blame him.
So, Josh at Lou Brown 34 would like to know the top three things management needs to do this offseason. Not just three things. There's the problem.
Yeah, well, I mean, they need to fill the outfield, right? That's the priority one. They're losing their left field. Well, they don't have a left fielder. I mean, it's been Steve Pierce all season, and they're losing Bautista. They need to replace those guys. I mean, Pierce has been fine, but he's miscast as an everyday outfielder.
It's an everyday anything, unfortunately, for Steve.
Yeah, that's. It's just the truth. He has a lot of trouble staying healthy, but so they need that. And there's guys out there. There's a lot of good outfielders in free agency, and I don't know if they're going to play at that level. Get the Justin Upton's, the JD Martinez, or the Lorenzo Cain's, but they should. If you're going to keep Bautista or not Bautista Donaldson, you're going to keep Happ. You're going to keep Estrada. You're going for it, right? So go for it.
There is always the question of being hamstrung by the contract at some point, and that's the eternal Toronto question. But so number one, fill the outfield. Number two, you probably need some real starting depth.
They need at least one more guy who's going to be a major league starter in, like, ready, that you would be happy with him opening the season in the rotation.
Yep. And then on the infield, you need a real answer for the question, what if Devin Travis is injured for half of a season or more again?
Yeah, and the answer can't be Ryan Goins.
Yeah, except if you can figure out a way that he only bats with runners on base and it remains 2017, then it's fine.
Yeah, and I just want to talk about this too, because so Mark Shapiro gave an interview and he called him a championship level backup or something, or potentially a starter on a good, and he was just talking.
Maybe that was the do-over I forgot about.
Now, and we rip on Goins a lot, but yeah, it's the thing with Ryan Goins. Like, he is a championship level backup if your starters are guys who are healthy. Like, he would make a great backup on the Yankees, where you got Didi Gregorius and Starlin Castro, and then you go stick him in for defense for Castro in the ninth because Castro's not a good defender. Yeah. But on a team like the Blue Jays, he just doesn't work. And he's just not good enough when you have injury-prone players at both of the middle infield spots.
Yeah, a team that is really trying to win 90 to 95 games and take a division cannot bear a replacement level guy who you know is going to get hundreds of plate appearances if your middle infielders are as difficult to manage as the two guys were this year. And I don't mean difficult personality wise, I mean to keep on the field. Was that three things or was that just two? That was three. All right. Sam Dowdle, is Teoscar Hernandez, now the phrasing here is a little off, I believe he's asking, is he a ready to be an everyday player on the Blue Jays in 2018?
I would hope that that's not the plan A.
You are no fun. Absolutely no fun at all.
Well, I think it might be plan A, but I don't know. We talked about some of the flaws that are there, right? And I think that those could get exposed very quickly. And so I'd love him to be a guy that you're ready to bring up if someone goes down, but not the guy that you're counting on to replace Jose Bautista's old version of his bat.
Yeah, it does seem like a stretch. But also I look at the guys who've been playing every day in left field, with the exception of the whatever magical ring or piece of clothing Ezekiel Carrera put on this year. Generally speaking, he would be not a downgrade from the looks of things in left field for the Blue Jays.
No, he's not. But I just want them to do better. I want him to be the first guy called up, or Alfred, one of the two, if someone goes down.
All right. Fair. I think you're always tough, but fair. Are you... So we're going to do two things at once here?
Except I'm talking about Marco Estrada.
Then you're not fair at all.
And I'm not tough either.
So we're going to do a cliche, and we're going to do the last question. So we'll do this cliche thing.
Man, what a cliche.
I thought writers hated cliches.
Yeah, that question would be from Shaky Waits, Rob Gray. How much should we take from September results? Is it truly fool's gold, like Pat Gillick once said? Or the other old adage I've heard is, never believe anything that you see in April and September. Which, if you read that, that's like, what, 33% of the season you shouldn't believe?
Yeah. Now, just remind us, Greg, what is your test for a cliche?
Well, if you say the opposite and it doesn't make any sense, clearly you've waded too deep into cliche territory.
Now, the opposite of never believe anything you see in September would be believe everything you see in September. I think that fits our definition.
Pretty much.
Yeah,
so there is a context to every month, and I suppose September is notably different than other months because of our baseball's mysterious obsession with expanding rosters to 40 people, yes?
Yes, that is definitely the biggest reason I believe that this thing exists.
Which really means the April thing doesn't... I don't even understand that. But anyway.
I guess it's because it's cold and... I don't know. But the real thing is, you know, we hear this, right? Should we not then be happy or take some way that we've seen Teoscar Hernandez be able to take Chris Sale deep? You see guys play against real players who are fighting for playoff spots or positions in standings and things like that. You know, there's a lot. Most of September baseball is real. And then you get these situations where you have, you know, Matt Dermody, or actually Dermody's pitching pretty well, but we have Luis Santos coming into a game in the seventh inning of a one-run game, right?
Or that happens a lot in
September too. Right. Well, though Tim Mesa, they're actually trying to turn him into something, but same idea, right? It's like seeing what we have. So yeah, if a guy's constantly beating up on the Tim Mesas of the world, if he's a right-hand hitter at least, it doesn't mean a whole lot. But if he's hitting, you know, Masahiro Tanaka, or like I said, Chris Sale, or what Don's doing, that stuff, I think maybe doesn't mean they're going to continue this, but it still has value.
Yeah, and I think you can see that in the difference between the results that Teoscar Hernandez has had and the results that Richard Urania has had, right? The more they play so far, you've got an idea that, you know, they might be in the lineup the same day. They're facing the same guys. Urania has been overmatched far more often than Hernandez has been overmatched. So you are learning something. Now, does that need to be tested more? Yes. So I would say, what should the phrase be? The phrase should be, don't only believe what you see in September.
Yeah, you know, consider the source and be skeptical of what you see in September, but don't disbelieve it.
Yeah. Lord knows if the Blue Jays had disbelieved Jose Bautista's 10 home runs in September, where would we be now?
There you go, full circle. Yeah, they offered him arbitration after that. They didn't necessarily have, and that was, he was a non-tender candidate, but they believed in some of the things they'd seen, some of the changes, and, you know, the rest is history.
Absolutely. We are also going to hand out a gold star this week, which I have the privilege of handing out.
I think that's rather brilliant.
So I did good, right?
I mean, I would have thought you'd get a gold star.
You enjoy that. You've earned it.
So we don't generally get too political on our little program here because, you know, I don't necessarily have a lot to say. But Bruce Maxwell did have something to say this week, and I think the fact that he said it by taking a knee during the national anthem at the Oakland A's game should be applauded. I think in a democratic society, people with a platform, any platform, who have a strong opinion about something should always be applauded for expressing their opinion in a thoughtful, considered way that attempts to really open up a discourse. So Maxwell explained to his teammates what he was going to do, why he was going to do it, that he really felt that the NFL players who are taking a stand, trying to take a stand against what they perceive as injustice against African-Americans, both in society in general, but specifically the violence that the police often enact upon them, that he was going to join that sentiment, that he, even though he's the son of a serviceman, believes that this topic needs a lot of attention. I think absolutely he had the right to do that, and I think in a free society, that it's critical that people with a platform do speak out. And yeah, there's all kinds of opinions about that, so I just want to give him a gold star that what he did obviously took courage, especially in baseball, the most traditional of sports, where there are not a lot of minorities. There's a fair number of minorities. There's not a lot of African-Americans playing in the major leagues in any given time. So he may feel like a minority among minorities in that case. So your gold star, Bruce, take it, hang it wherever you would like.
Yeah, I have nothing to add to that.
Usually when I get on a big rant, that's how you finish it off.
Yeah, well, you definitely touched all the bases. So there you go. Gold star.
I will give you the opportunity then to have a final thought, which probably won't be nearly as serious as the gold star I just handed out.
Nope. going from that to just abstract silliness, because the Detroit Tigers have nothing to play for, and Brad Ausmus definitely has nothing to play for because he's already been told he's going to be fired or not renewed at the end of the season. He's going to let Andrew Romine. Austin Romine's the catcher for the Yankees.
I was going to say, that can get really confusing too. Are they related? Are they brothers?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's going to let Andrew Romine play all nine positions on the Sunday final game of the season. He'll be the fifth player to do that.
Which is, if nothing else, a reason to tune into a Detroit Tigers game, which I don't think anybody had a reason to tune into, even the players, by the last day of the season.
Nope. this will give the Tigers the all-time lead in players who have done this, because it'll be the second one for them. And don't ask me if the first one was, I don't know. I just saw that tweeted out.
They got to lead in something this year. How about lead in trading guys who became the most awesome player on the planet to another team? One JD Martinez
for nothing. Okay, maybe not nothing, but the return they got was crazy low for a guy as good as JD Martinez was with them and has been with Arizona.
That's for another team's podcast, I think, but you're absolutely right. My final thought is also not Blue Jays related. It's Nacho Man. If you're not familiar with Nacho Man, you can just type Nacho Man in and he shows up as the very first Google result, because in our modern fame induced society, all you need to get famous is to have Addison Russell kick the Ruffles? Nachos out of your hand.
No, they're nachos.
Oh, I don't even know what kind of chips they were. Yes, Nacho Man had the Cubs shortstop destroy his snack. Not only did he end up with a free snack, he ended up getting interviewed by at least two different major news outlets and then having people ask for his autograph repeatedly, including signing another man's chest with what else? Nacho cheese. If you have not had enough absurdity this week, I encourage you to take in all the glory that is Nacho Man. As I tweeted at Dart Guy, remember, Dart Guy is verified. I'm not on Twitter. Think about that. Dart Guy and Nacho Man may be doing a buddy cop movie, although Dart Guy would like to play himself.
I think that you should be required to have in your Twitter bio hashtag 15 minutes. If that's what you want.
It's a special check mark. It's like a orange check mark. Like it's about to expire. It's a little clock. Yeah. Yeah, it's not a check mark at all. It's a clock ticking down. Oh, my goodness. So, quickly, of course, I must remind you that we do have a Patreon, not only because I love plugging our Patreon, but because we have a new patron, Deco Cuff. Deco, thank you very much for your donation. You are at that level where in the off season you can come on and play a game with us. And if I have mispronounced your name, because I'm not familiar with it, you can correct me when you come on to play a game. Possibly a little swing and a drive. Maybe we'll come up with something else that suits you. I'd also like to encourage our wonderful, faithful listeners, if you want to just slide on over to iTunes and rate the podcast or even leave a short review. As well, there's a new service that was brought to our attention that we were added to called Podknife, which is also looking for reviews and ratings for podcasts. You can look them up as well and give your opinion on us. We always appreciate that. Helps other people find the podcast. That said, you have been Joshua Housem at Joshua Housem, and I have been Greg Wisniewski at Coolhead 2010. And our guest, you're going to help me out with this one.
TJ Zoic at TJ Zoic.
Well, that's easy, isn't it? Even without the check mark, that really is TJ. So we have confirmed that. And this was Artificial Turf Wars episode number 76. And we'll talk to you next week.